Hello and welcome to Vanguard Audiobooks. I'm Alex Linder and you can find everything that we record at vnnforum.com. Today we're going to do two more chapters that are related from Henry Ford's Unabridged, The International Jew, The World's Foremost Problem. We've already done 50. As I say, they're up at VNN Forum. Chapters we're going to do today are about Zionism and Palestine. They are chapter 51 and chapter 52. Chapter 51 is Will Jewish Zionism Bring Armageddon? And chapter 52 is How the Jews Use Power by an Eyewitness, someone who was involved over in that region. And again, these were written as part of the series of investigative articles by the Dearborn Independent out of Dearborn, Michigan, Henry Ford's paper, back in 1920 and 21, over a couple of years. And the best of the articles were put together in the four-volume, 80-chapter book we've been doing audio, text, and commentary on. So let's get started with chapter 51. Will Jewish Zionism Bring Armageddon? When the British Army passed into Jerusalem and the memorable capture of the city in 1917, Britain captured Jerusalem in 1917, the protocols went in with it. A symbolic circle was thus closed, though not in the way the protocolists had hoped. The man who carried the protocols knew what they signified, and they were carried not in triumph, but as the plans of the enemies of world liberty. And again, this is written, 27 years before Israel formally comes into existence. Zionism is the best advertised of all present Jewish activities and has exerted a greater influence upon world events than the average man realizes. In its more romantic aspects, it makes an appeal to Christian as well as to Jew, because there are certain prophecies which are held to concern the return of the Jews to Jerusalem. When this return takes place, certain great events are scheduled to ensue. Because of this admixture of the religious sentiment, it will be rather difficult for a certain class of people to scrutinize modern political Zionism. They have been too well propagandized into believing that political Zionism and the return promised by the prophets are the same thing. Having succumbed to the initial confusion of mistaking Judah for Israel, they have entirely mistaken the ancient writings that relate to these two, and have made the single tribe of Judah, whence comes the name Jew, the hub around which all history and humanity swing. Judah was the tribe with which Israel could not live in peace over 2,000 years ago, and which has the fateful gift of stirring up the same kind of dissension today. And yet no one ever thought of charging the 10 tribes of Israel with anti-Semitism. So, through Christian lack of paying attention to details, they get even their fictional story wrong, leading to endless misery. Remember, even back then, the theory that dispensationalism is what it's called, had just been invented fairly recently, or at least within the last, after 1850, and it really not even was beginning, I think, to catch on during this period. The idea that Israel had to be reformed and then Jesus would come back and all the rest of the garbage that captured the mind, basically of the American evangelicals, and made them support Israel when it came into existence. This is what he's talking about before it's really gotten going. Zionism is challenging the attention of the world today because it is creating a situation out of which many believe the next war will come. To adopt a phraseology familiar to students of prophecy, it is believed by many students of world affairs that Armageddon will be the direct result of what is now beginning to be manifested in Palestine. For these, if for no other reasons, the subject becomes important. With Zionism as a dream of pious Jews, this article has nothing to do. With Zionism as a political fact, every first-class government is now compelled to have something to do. It is a bigger question than the German indemnities or American immigration, because it lies back of both and is rapidly proceeding under the cover of both. It is worthy of note, if only in passing, that Zionism in the active modern political sense took its rise racially and geographically where Bolshevism arose, namely in Russia, and that its center, the seat of its Inner Actions Committee, IAC, was at Berlin. There was always a close relationship between the Zionists of Russia and the New York Kahila, which we've heard about in earlier segments, earlier chapters, as is evidenced by public utterances made in Russia after the revolution in which the Kahila is extolled. At the time the war was declared in 1914, the Interactions Committee was spread about in various countries. For example, Dr. Shmarya Levin, S-C-H-M-A-R-Y-A, Levin, L-E-V-I-N, of Berlin. Dr. Shmarya Levin of Berlin was in the U.S. and remained here. He was a Russian rabbi, German scholar, and cosmopolitan. Although his headquarters were in Berlin, he remained in the United States and became recognized as the leader of the leaders of Zionism, until the Great Jewish Shift of Versailles, the Peace Conference, after World War I. Another member of the Interactions Committee was one Jacobson, who was in Constantinople. Quote, when he saw that Constantinople could no longer be the center of Zionist politics, he left and went to Copenhagen, Denmark, where in a neutral country he could be of practical usefulness to the Zionists by transmitting information and funds. Guide to Zionism, page 80. In fact, the entire Interactions Committee, with headquarters at Berlin, moved freely through a warlocked world, the only exceptions being Warburg and Hantke, H-A-N-T-K-E, and there was no need for the Berlin Warburg to move about, for there were others who represented him. Dr. Levin gave his sanction for the shifting of the center of Jewish gravity from Berlin to America and, quote, as early as August 30, 1914, a month after the outbreak of war, an extraordinary conference of American Zionists was called in New York. What this change of seat meant has formed the subject of much discussion. In 1914, the Jews apparently knew more about the probable duration of the war than did the principals. Because they have this incredible global spy network, or network that amounts to a spy network, that's one of its uses as well as commercial uses and other uses, mutual support, the Jews are in better position than the people who are actually fighting to know what the outcome of the war is likely to be. It was not to be a mere excursion through Belgium, as some fancied. There was time to dicker, to show the value of certain Jewish support to the governments. Germany gladly pledged the land of Palestine to the Jews, but the Jews had already seen what Wilhelm had done in that ancient state when he enthroned himself on the Mount of Olives. Evidently, the Allies won the contest of making promises, for on November 2, 1917, when General Allenby was pushing up through Palestine with his British army, Arthur James Balfour, the British Secretary of State for Foreign Affairs, issued the famous declaration approving Palestine as a national home for the Jewish people. Quote, the wording of it came from the British Foreign Office, but the text had been revised in the Zionist offices in America as well as in England. The British declaration was made in the form in which the Zionists desired it, and, in italics, the last clauses were added, stop italics, in order to appease a certain section of timid anti-Zionist opinion. Again, from A Guide to Zionism, pages 85-86. Now please read the declaration and note the italicized clauses just referred to. Quote, His Majesty's government view with favor the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people and will use their best endeavors to facilitate the achievement of this object, it being clearly understood that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of non-Jewish communities in Palestine or the rights and the political status enjoyed by Jews in any other country. So a fig leaf of, we're not going to disrupt the natives, but in actuality it's justification for taking over. Zionism is of particular interest not merely because of the quarrels which have arisen among the leaders over money. It is the war of, quote, interest against, quote, capital, but also because of the light it throws on the two great armies of Jews in the world, the way in which they use their power where they can, and the trouble that always embroils the nations which become Jewish tools. People sometimes ask why Jewry, which is capitalistic, should favor Bolshevism, which is the announced enemy of capital. It is an interesting question. Why should a New York Jewish financier, an officer of the government of the United States, help finance a, quote, red, unquote, publication which even our tolerant government cannot stomach? In addition to the fact that it is only Gentile capital that is attacked, The answer is that the Jew who has fallen for the worship of the golden calf is anxious to keep in the good graces of the Jew of the East, the Mongolian Jews who are rampaging against orderly systems of society. It is quite useful when there is a revolution in Paris to have the 600 houses which you may own spared by the incendiary mob, as were Rothschild's houses. Zionism has been one of the subjects upon which Western and Eastern Jew can unite. Indeed, it was the Eastern Jew that compelled the Western Jew to take a favorable stand on this matter. The Jewish gentlemen who are receiving the freedom of our cities today, in their various aspects as, quote, German and, quote, British scientists, are Eastern Jews. So Jews are basically divided into Russian or German types, Polish-Russian versus the more civilized Western German ones, is what he's saying. Capitalist versus Mongol communist. But they're all on the same side. They have come to a contest with the Jews of America on the question of money. The Jews of America have smothered some very ugly charges. The Jews of the East, more recently of Germany or England, are not likely to be browbeaten by the money bags of Jewish New York, for the Eastern type of Jew knows a situation in which money is the most useless thing in the world. And that is why he is feared and favored by Western Jewry of the golden calf, that is, violence, bloodshed, the abattoir that the communists create. Is a standing threat even to other Jews, so they comply and they work with their Jewish Mongol butchers. The Jewish defenders are just now capitalizing the split in Jewry. The real split will come when the Jews of wisdom begin to support the attempts which have been made to liberate the Jews from their leaders. This internal squabble means nothing but a squabble of leaders, but when the Jews themselves divide, one side for 20th century light and the destruction of the class power of selfish leaders, then we may look up hopefully. And again here, I don't know if he was the first to do this, but this is a common theme, is that, oh, the problem is the Jews are held tight by their rabbis. If we can just convince the average Jew he has nothing to fear, then he'll come away from the rabbis. But that has not proven to be workable. That's a standing hope entertained by some, but in my opinion, it's a delusional hope. There are too many concrete advantages Jews gain from remaining within the fold for 99.9% of them ever to leave. When the Jew recognizes the honesty of his critics and the righteousness of what they charge, then there will be a split, but not before. The division in Jewry, as evidenced by the contempt of the Revolutionary Party for the Financial Party, and as even more strongly evidenced by the fear of the Revolutionary Party by the Financial Party, is being brought about by the insincerity of the Western Jew's Zionism. The Western Jew says that the United States is the promised land. Profits and interest are the milk and honey, quote, and New York is Jerusalem. The Jew of Russia has another view. So, is Palestine the promised land, or is the U.S. the land of milk and honey, the promised land? A knowledge of political Zionism is worthwhile also as an authoritative illustration of what the Jew does when he is in power. Heretofore, there has been Russia to illustrate this, but now there is Palestine. With every fact against them, with every traveler and observer giving them the lie direct, there are still Jewish spokesmen and poor befuddled Gentile fronts, quote unquote, who insist that Bolshevism is not Jewish and that Russia is not now governed by Jews. It is just this constant denial of facts, this failure to use their opportunity to be honest, that is going to the judgment of the Jewish leaders, or that is going to be the judgment of the Jewish leaders. Bolshevism all over the world, not in Russia only, but in New York, Chicago, and New Orleans, and San Francisco, is Jewish. Bolshevism is Jewish all over the world, says Henry Ford. And this is what the punch-pulling professional conservative book writers will never tell you, even as they whine on about it and tell you liberals are stupid. But the people that actually think are stupid are their followers and readers, their market. However, there is no need further to insist upon that, except occasionally to add confirmatory illustrations of it. Bolshevism all over the world is Jewish. More to the present point is Palestine. It will be very difficult for the most irresponsible Jewish spokesman to deny that Palestine is Jewish. The government is Jewish. The plan of procedure is Jewish. The methods used are Jewish. Does anyone rise to deny that? Scarcely. Very well, then. Palestine will do to illustrate the genius of the Jew when he comes to power. Professor Albert T. Clay in the Atlantic Monthly, will anyone declare that this long-established and thoroughly respectable Boston publication is anti-Semitic? Warns us that the information about Palestine which we receive in America comes to us through the Jewish Telegraph Service, which is the Associated Press of Worldwide Jewry, and the Zionist propaganda. The latter, he says, quote, with its harrowing stories of pogroms in Europe and its misrepresentations of the situation in the Near East, has been able to awaken not a little sympathy for the Zionist propaganda. This propaganda of pogroms, thousands upon thousands of Jews killed, amounts to nothing except as it illustrates the gullibility of the press. No one believes this propaganda, and governments regularly disprove it. But the fact it continues indicates that something besides facts is necessary to keep the scheme going. In Jerusalem, as this is being written, martial law is proclaimed. There has been a struggle between the native inhabitants, whom the Balfour Declaration sought to protect, and the new-come Jews. As in the famous Easter disorders of last year, the wounded in the hospital showed that the Jews were armed and the natives fought with whatever weapons they could find on the spot, the conclusion of all impartial observers under the circumstances being that the Jews prepared for and sought to fight with unprepared natives. The mark of disorder perpetrated by the Jews is all over the place, the persecuted turned persecutor, and lest this should be charged to the general wildness of the people in Palestine, let it be said that the rioters were only expressing in deeds what cultivated American and English Jews have expressed in words, namely that the lawful inhabitants of the land ought to be driven out, in spite of governmental promises to the contrary. One of the first Easter rioters, Jabotinsky, whom British authorities sentenced to 15 years in prison, was released immediately upon the arrival of Sir Herbert Samuel, that's an English Jew, and is now traveling in state and is talked of as a possible successor to Sir Herbert, although he is originally one of the Russian Bolsheviki, come down to practice the gentle arts of that tribe in Palestine. The government is Jewish. Sir Herbert Samuel is High Commissioner representing the power of the British government, which holds the mandate over Palestine. The head of the Judicial Department, who appoints the judges of Palestine, is a Jew. Christian or Muslim judges who do not give the Jews a shade the better of the proceedings are ousted. The condition not unknown in New York, so always give the Jews a bit of a nod in the court. So they're getting more than equal treatment. Chaim Weizmann is head of the Department of Works. He is a Jew, now traveling in this country and having the polite lie passed to him occasionally by Judge Julian W. Mack. In fact, at the heads of all departments are Jews, a former New York Jew being the head of the Department of Immigration, who has made splendid rules for the protection of Palestine from an undesirable class of Jews, rules so well adapted for the purpose that if the Congress of the United States should adopt them, the cry of persecution would girdle the world. So, long before, decades before Israel is established, you've got literal communist Bolsheviks like Jabotinsky down in Palestine attacking and mistreating the natives, even though Jews have agreed that the rights of the local people would be protected. Jews are a race of liars. Their gift to the world is communism, the butchering of mankind. Particularly whites. Jews are our enemy. How can we have an enemy in that? We have an enemy. It's called Jews. We need to acknowledge it, not worship it. It is to be noted that the Jewish government of Palestine is very much like that of Russia, mostly foreign. Trotsky came from the east side of New York. A gentleman recently released from Bolshevik custody told the writer that the governor of his prison was an ordinary Jew who formerly lived on 14th Street, Detroit. Practically every big American city is represented in the Bolshevik government of Russia. There is another full-fledged government waiting in this country for service whenever necessary. That's for the U.S. The methods being adopted to get the land are such as will fill the world with indignation once the world fully understands what is being done, and that it is done with the knowledge and approval of the Zionist commissioner is indicated by the fact that he suspended the activities of the British officer who endeavored to stop the abuse. It was the old game of lending money at an exorbitant rate of interest to people hard pressed by war and crop failure, and then seizing their land when they could not pay. The bank that did this was the Anglo-Palestine Bank, a Zionist concern. This British officer, to save the people and the land, made arrangements with a British bank to lend them money at 6.5% with 5 years to pay. If payment failed, the land was to go to the government for redistribution, not to the Zionist bank. This was the humane plan which the Zionist commissioner forbade, whereupon the British officer resigned. Some effort was afterward made to redress the terrible act, but there it stands as the well-considered action of Jewry and power. Then follows what is described by every impartial observer as an, quote, arrogant attempt to expropriate everything in sight. In Russia, it could have been done very easily under the plea of nationalization, but there was Great Britain, whose laws do not condone theft. The only schools that have been established in Jerusalem have been built and manned by the so-called Gentiles, although the Jews of Jerusalem have been the pensioners of worldwide Jewry for centuries. As long ago as 1842, Dr. Murray M. Chain, M'CHEYNE, noted that the Jerusalem Jews cared nothing for schools because their children were only growing up into pensioners too. But Christians, with a warm regard for the holy city, set about to improve the miserable condition of the Jewish inhabitants, and thus it came that at the time of the Zionist invasion, a considerable number of Jewish children were in attendance at the schools. The newcome Zionist leaders demanded that the best schools be given up to them. Of course, this was refused. Quote, the Council of Jerusalem Jews, quote, then caused it to be published in the Hebrew Daily that parents who did not withdraw their children from the schools would be punished. And now look at the typical punishments threatened. If any parent refused whose name was on the list of the American Relief Fund, the relief would be withdrawn. An interesting bit of news to subscribers to that fund. Doctors would be forbidden to visit the families that had children attending the enlightened schools. Their names would be sent to the blacklist at the places where circumcision was performed, so that newborn descendants of the recalcitrants might be refused the right of Moses. They would be denied all share in Zionist benefits or funds. If they were in business, they would be boycotted. If there were workmen, they could get no work. Anyone who refused, this is a quote, let him know that it was forbidden for him to be called by the name of Jew. They will be fought by all lawful means. Their names will be put upon a monument of shame and their deeds made to reproach them to the last generation. If they are supported, their support will cease. If they are rabbis, they will be moved far from their office. They shall be put under the ban and persecuted. And all the world will know that in this justice there has been no mercy. It is the Jewish Bolshevist spirit all over again, that spirit which so many people have been vainly endeavoring to reconcile with the Russian temperament, because it is so un-Russian. It is tyranny, and not the tyranny of strength, but of meanness and darkness. It is now perfectly clear what was meant by Dr. McInnes, M-C-I-N-N-I-S, who is Anglican Bishop of Jerusalem, when he said, quote, the emigrants so far brought in to Palestine under the commission did not include many respectable English Jews, but they did include a great number of Russians, Poles, and Romanians, many of them thoroughly Bolshevik in their attitude to the government. Unquote. If this spirit obtains at the beginning of a movement, which the Christian world has been taught by propaganda to regard as a profoundly religious and respectable exodus, it burdens the imagination to forecast what will be done in a period of full and unquestioned rule. And he correctly anticipates what the Jews do today, which is just shoot, torture, and laugh, and photograph their ongoing holocaust of the Palestinians. So the Christians are fed, the Jews feed Christians propaganda about the holy people returning to their ancient land, when the reality is they're a bunch of communist massacrers who who are going there and using their Bolshevik methods to terrorize the locals, the natives. Observing and weighing the events and tendencies of Jewish rule thus far in Palestine, it is not difficult to see the purpose in it all. The Jews still distrust their ability to make a state. They do not distrust the world's willingness to let them have a state. Indeed, it is amazing how naturally the Jews place confidence in that portion of the world they have always affected to despise. But deep-seated in the Jew is a distrust of himself. He doesn't know how his people will contrive to live together. He doesn't know how they will contrive to drop the principles and practices which are so destructive of social comity elsewhere. And he feels that, patient as the mandatory power may now be, it is doubtful how long that patience will hold out under the blunders and brutalities that will be inseparable from Zionist rule, if any deductions can be drawn from the facts at hand. Therefore, feeling that the time may be short, he is endeavoring by such actions as interference with the cultural question, with the racial rights of the natives, and by such schemes as the land-grabbing device described above, to get so strong a hold on the situation as will seriously complicate it whenever Great Britain shall feel it to be her duty to the world to step in and attempt to bring some kind of order out of the chaos. Remember, we're 28 years before the foundation of Israel. The King David Hotel, the Jews blow up in one of the first modern incidents of terrorism and try to, of course, also false flag it onto other people. So they're perfectly willing to kill the British, as time would show. It begins to be very clear that Jewish nationalism will develop along the line of an enmity to the rest of the world. Already the dangerous proposal has been made to organize a Jewish army for the protection of the Suez Canal. Instead of thinking of roads and farmsteads, of vineyards and oil presses, of schools and sanitary villages, the Jews are thinking of elevating themselves into the military power that shall stand between the East and West on that most strategic strip of ground in the world. The whole situation is fraught with danger, and men who wish well to the Jews are alarmed and saddened by the prospect. There are three elements of danger in the situation as it exists today. The overwhelmingly predominant Bolshevik element that is being poured into Palestine, the intense egotistic and challenging nationalism that Zionists exhibit even before they get a potato patch, the taste for world politics and world power, and the racial confusion which now exists in Palestine. These combined are dynamite. The first is more vital than many realize. Already the Jews who have gone to Palestine at great sacrifice and for pious reasons are complaining that instead of the Psalms of David, the people are singing songs of the Red Revolution. And instead of meeting for instruction and prayer there, there are riotous gatherings extolling Trotsky as Messiah and the Soviet as the Kingdom of Heaven. On the third anniversary of the Jewish Revolution in Russia, the streets of Jerusalem were placarded with sentiments of blasphemy and treason, and May Day this year was devoted to the exaltation of anarchy. This fact will be of interest to students of prophecy. It is as certain as any human forecast can be that this sort of thing will not be permitted to go forward in the face of the world. It is unimaginable that the nations responsible to humanity for the conduct of that important strip of territory will remain supine while Bolshevism spreads under the false pretense of a religious movement favored by Christendom. An attempt will be made to stop it. The Jews of Palestine will turn on their sponsor nation. The Jews of Russia will come down to help. Great Britain and perhaps the United States will defend the old, pure vision of a Jerusalem redeemed. Then will come to pass the prophecy of Zechariah, quote, "And Judah also shall fight against Jerusalem," unquote. Judah also. It is a thought to make a Jew bethink himself where the lawlessness of the East and the materialism of the West will lead him. Against Jerusalem. What a terrible ending of Judah's present mad delusion. Palestine has been called the center of the earth. It is. The power that controls Palestine controls the world. Although exercising no sovereignty over the land itself, Great Britain's control of the adjacent waters and of Egypt and Persia and India forms the key of her power. The white race has thus far been the chosen people to whom the dominion of the earth has been given. Palestine is the key to world military strategy and trade. In question 12 of the questions, and Answers, published by the Department of Education, Zionist Organization of America, this occurs. 12. What are the commercial possibilities of Palestine? Answer. The location of Palestine between the three continents favors foreign trade. All this lends itself to dreams of future glory, and many Christian friends of the Jew have pleased themselves by conceiving an universal Hague at Jerusalem and a new social order going out to bless the nations from Zion. It is the idea conveyed by men like A.A. Burrell in books like The World's Significance of a Jewish State. All this might be expected if the Jews of today were Old Testament people, anxious to reestablish the social laws of Moses, which are conceded to be the best safeguards ever devised against pauperism on the one hand and plutocracy on the other. But Palestine has not fallen into the hands of that sort of Jews. Before the dream can be fulfilled, Judah must come to himself, as he has not yet, for from of old the word is, and Judah also shall fight against Jerusalem. The racial situation in Palestine just now is very delicate. Americans do not understand it. The Zionist propaganda has always been accepted on the assumption that Palestine is the Jews' land and that they only need to go back. They only need help to go back. It is an historical and political fact that Palestine has not been the Jews' land for more than 2,000 years. There are in Palestine 500,000 Muslims, 105,000 Christians, and 65,000 Jews. The industry of the land is agriculture. Engaged in this are 69% of the Muslims, 46% of the Christians, and 19% of the Jews. Neither numerically nor industrially have they held the land. Yet as the result of a war bargain, it is handed over to them, as regardless of the native inhabitants, as if Belgium had been handed over to Mexico. Many of the natives are Semites, like the Jews, but they do not want the Jews among them. That is a strange fact for those who use the term anti-Semitism. Why do real Semites also dislike the Jews? Surely Semites are not victims of, quote, anti-Semitism. The Balfour Declaration, as well as the terms of the mandate adopted at San Remo, recognized the rights of the native races. Indeed, everyone who knows about the people who have been native to Palestine for 2,000 years recognizes their rights, everybody except the Jews. Bethlehem was a Christian town, as befits the birthplace of Christ. Yet the Jews have contrived that 2,000 Bethlehemites leave Palestine rather than submit to what they see coming. The other races are not so placid about it, hence the trouble. It is now that the last clauses, added as the Zionist historian declares, quote, in order to appease a certain section of anti-Zionist opinion, quote, begin to get a meaning for the reader. Was the purpose only to quiet disturbing questions until all the arrangements were made? Evidently, it was then a dishonest appeasement. Such may have been the Zionists' intention, but no one need expect perjury on the part of the responsible nations. The end of the matter will see those last clauses redeemed by honest application of their terms to the people involved. Again, baseless hopes. Baseless beliefs that somehow, some way, other goy nations are going to come in and clear up these problems. Never happened. They got worse. They're still getting worse. General Allenby promised those native races of Palestine that their rights would be respected. So did the Balfour Declaration. So did the San Remo Conference. So did President Wilson in the 12th of his 14 points. But Judah says, let them get out. The last clauses were added in order to appease a certain section of timid anti-Zionist opinion. Let them get out, says Israel Zangwill. We must gently persuade them to trek. This is a quote. After all, they have all Arabia with its million square miles, and Israel has not a square inch. There is no particular reason for the Arabs to cling to those few kilometers, to fold their tents and silently to steal away as their proverbial habit. Let them exemplify it now. Aside from the falsity of using the term Arab, there is the delightful Jewishness of it. Let them give it up to us. We want it. Americans have been in their land less than 150 years as a nation, and there is China and Arabia and Siberia for us to go to if we should want to. But we prefer our own country, and so do the native races of Palestine, who have dwelt there for 2,000 years. The watchmen on the towers of the world are alarmed at what seems brewing in Judah's geographical cauldron. And that ends chapter 51. First of two about what's going on in Palestine. We see, okay, so they're bringing in all these Russians, and they're just simply brazenly with their typical chutzpah, their racial brazenness, telling the locals to scram, get lost. This is our land now. That's how Jews operate. People of the lie. Chapter 52, how the Jews use power by an eyewitness. The Jewish question continues to mount the scale of public opinion, attracting an ever higher type of mind to the discussion of its significance. When the Dearborn Independent first began to print some of the results of its research into the question, the initial response was largely from those who disliked the Jew because he was a Jew. This class expected to find in the Dearborn Independent a spokesman for all their coarse humor and abuse. The method that was followed by this paper, however, was not abusive enough nor bitter enough to satisfy Jew baiters and Jew haters, and gradually a new response from another class began to be heard, which by this time has attained massive proportions. The better class of people, seeing that racial and religious prejudice had no part in the work, began to consider the question, capital Q, with relation to our American life and the future of this nation as a Christian people. Upon this ascent of the discussion to its proper plane, the better periodicals began to give thoughtful attention to the matter. These publications have been referred to in previous articles. There is to be added to the list Century Magazine for September, which contains an article by Herbert Adams Gibbons, which clearly intends to be fair and is certainly able, in spite of a difference of opinion that might exist with regard to some of the author's conclusions. Mr. Gibbons states some matters more plainly than they have been stated outside the pages of the Dearborn Independent, and some matters he states just as plainly, and he will be justified by the unprejudiced reader. One of the most notable studies of the Jewish question has come out of the University of the South at Sewanee, Tennessee. It is entitled Zionism and the Jewish Problem, the author being the Reverend Dr. John P. Peters, former canon residentiary of the Cathedral of St. John the Divine, Morningside Heights, New York, also Rector Emeritus of St. Michael's Church, New York, and Professor of New Testament Languages and Literature in the University of the South. The article has been reprinted from the Sewanee Review and makes a brochure of 29 pages. Dr. Peters begins with an historical sketch of the development of the two lines of thought among the Jews, the nationalistic, which made for exclusiveness, and the religious, which made for inclusiveness, and he describes the domination of the latter by the former with the coming of modern Zionism, which he finds to be racial and not religious. He says, quote, "The dominant control of the Zionist party is at present in the hands of those who are not religious, but merely racial Jews. He believes that the development of race consciousness along these lines, quote, must be inevitably in the end to make the Jews bad citizens of the United States or of any other country, and to keep alive and increase the hostility to the Jews." This monograph by Dr. Peters will repay study. By permission, the Dearborn Independent reprints the article from page 20 to the end, this portion being selected because it deals with Dr. Peters' testimony as an eyewitness of certain conditions in Palestine. The italics are ours, there being none in the university reprint. So this is going to be, the rest of this article is going to be from this fellow Dr. Peters' article in the Sewanee Review on what conditions are like in Palestine. The experiment of the Zionist homeland is now being tried. It is too early to determine fully how it will work, but it is at least of interest to consider its manifestations so far. My earliest contact with Zionism and Zionistic influences in Palestine dates from 1902. When I first visited Palestine in 1890, the Jews in Jerusalem were almost exclusively of old Oriental Sephardic families. Remember, 90% of Jews are Ashkenazi Jews, and 10% are Sephardic. And he's saying originally in Palestine, back before 1900, the Jews you did find there were of old Oriental Sephardic families. Jerusalem was still then the old Jerusalem within the walls. There were no houses without. Jewish colonization, economic and philanthropic in character, had just then begun on the Sharon Plain. But what little there was in the way of colonization was feeble, unsuccessful, exotic, an attempt to replace the persecuted Jews of Russia on the land, where, however, the Jew, unused to manual and especially farm labor, sat under an umbrella to protect himself from the sun and engaged native Syrians to do the work. On my next visit in 1902, more colonies had been planted and a serious effort was being made to turn the Jewish colonists into farmers. The majority of Jews who had come to Palestine, however, were settled about Jerusalem, and the New Jerusalem without the walls was larger, in space at least, than the Old Jerusalem within. The Alliance Israelite had developed their splendid... Let me redo that. The Alliance Israelite had developed their splendid schools to teach agriculture and manual and industrial arts. I was urgently solicited by the management to visit and inspect these schools. Here I found Jew, Muslim, and Christian working side by side without prejudice. This was, in my judgment, the best work of any sort being done in Palestine for two reasons. The worth of manual labor, which the Oriental of all sorts had heretofore despised, regarding it as unworthy of any man of intelligence or capacity. Secondly, because they brought Muslim, Christian, and Jew together on a plane of common work and common worth, the most valuable agent for the breaking down of those ancient prejudices, religious, racial, and social, which have been the curse and bane of the land. I was asked to put this down in writing because I was told great pressure was being exerted, I regret to say especially from America, to prevent the management from continuing this particular work of teaching the Jew, Christian, and Muslim on the same plane, the demand being that the Jew should not be brought into such contact with the Muslim and the Christian, and that he alone should be trained, that he might not be infected, as it were, by the others, and that they might not be prepared to compete with him for possession of the land. This spirit I met in a more thoroughly organized and offensive form on my latest visit in 1919 and 1920. I found immense progress in the development of the agricultural colonies. There was still difficulty in persuading the Jew, except not only the African or Arabian Jew, to do the actual work of the colony, but colonies were prospering and fruit culture, vine culture, and especially the manufacture of wine and liquors on a grand and most scientific scale had progressed wonderfully. In general, the land occupied by these colonies was not in a proper sense ancient Jewish land. They were on the Sharon and the Esdraelon plains, and in the extreme upper end of the Jordan Valley. But those regions were being enriched, and the country at large benefited by the colonists. The great bulk of the Jews were still gathered in Jerusalem as heretofore, and they were on one hand the intellectuals, and on the other hand the parasitic or pauperized Jew, what would ordinarily be regarded as the very best and the very worst. Life in the colonies was often very sweet and very lovely, a wholesome, normal family life, and an exhibition in peace and prosperity of what religious Judaism at its best may be. In Jerusalem, one found the extremes of intensely narrow and bitter orthodoxy and unbelief with extreme Bolshevik radicalism. Here, too, aggressive Zionism manifested itself in an attitude of bumptiousness and aggressiveness. The country is for the Jew. It belonged to him, and he would shortly take possession. One was made to feel that one's presence in the land was objected to. The Hebrew press contained angry diatribes against the existence of Christian schools and missions. The attitude taken by these Zionists at first alarmed, then aroused and irritated enormously, the native population, both Christian and Muslim, making the Jew an object of dread and hatred as he had never been before. I had opportunities to talk on intimate and friendly terms with leaders in all camps, albeit I was unable, through language difficulties, to communicate with the rank and file as freely as I should like to have done. I felt myself the annoyance and in some places the danger of the animosity aroused. Under government order, I was not permitted to visit certain sections of the country on account of the raids or uprisings of the Arabs, partly due to animosity roused by their apprehension of the Jewish invasion, and partly due to banditry, which took advantage of that as an occasion. In other parts, it was difficult to travel, because any stranger, unless he could prove the contrary, was suspected of being an agent of the Zionists, spying out the land for possession by the Jews. It was difficult to obtain lodgings or food, and there were sometimes unpleasantly hostile demonstrations on account of these suspicions. Everywhere it was believed that the Jew, by unfair means, was seeking to oust the true owners and to take possession of their land. In Jerusalem, it was asserted that the Zionist funds, or the Jewish funds that the Zionists could influence or control, were used to subsidize Jewish artisans or merchants to underbid Christians and Muslims and thus oust them by unfair competition, and that similar means were being used to acquire lands or titles to lands. It was even believed by many that the English authorities were unduly favoring and helping the Jews in these endeavors, as is shown by a letter from a Christian in Jaffa, published in the Atlantic Monthly. Quote, "We are already feeling that we have a government within a government. British officers cannot stand on the right side because they are afraid of being removed from their posts or ticked off." End quote. From time immemorial, the Jews the world over have contributed for the help of pious Jews in Jerusalem and the other sacred cities, Hebron, Tiberias, and Safed, the so-called Halukah, or Dole, in return for which the Jews in those cities were to win merit for themselves and those who contributed to their support by study of the law, prayer, and pious observances. St. Paul carried over the same practice into the Christian church, causing alms to be collected in the different congregations to be transferred to Jerusalem for the benefit and support of the Christians living there. To this day, annual collections are taken in the Roman Catholic churches throughout the world, which go to the Franciscans for the same use in Jerusalem. The Greeks and Armenians have like customs. In the past, there have been no prejudice with regard to these doles, but now, it was claimed, the Zionist committees were using the monies thus collected or contributed to organize and help their people in a systematized attempt to gain the upper hand in the land. Perhaps the attitudes of the extremists who possess the dominating power in the community can best be shown by the utterances of one of their own organs written in Hebrew. It should be stated that the English edition of this journal was, as a rule, quite different in its contents from the Hebrew edition. British in public, Yiddish in private. One article entitled "Malignant Leprosy" is a denunciation of parents who allow their children to go to any school except those under the control of Jews and conforming to the demands of the local Zionist committee. Parents are notified that a list has been made by the Zionist committee of all children who are attending foreign schools, even though they are not subjected to any religious teaching, and it is demanded that they shall be withdrawn from the schools and placed in schools where they shall be taught the Hebrew language, customs, and traditions, and kept separate from contamination by the Gentile, with his different ways and customs. Those teaching in foreign schools or schools not complying with the conditions laid down by this committee are ordered to withdraw from their positions. The malignant leprosy is the contamination by the outside world which results from education with the Gentiles. It is admitted in this article, in answer to protests, that the opportunities in some non-Jewish schools are better than in the Jewish schools. For example, in the teaching of foreign languages, so important for conducting business or securing employment, that there is greater diligence in instructing, and better hours and better care of pupils. Nevertheless, parents are informed that they must sacrifice for the sake of their race those chances for their children, doing their best meanwhile to raise their own schools to the higher level. Those who are failing to live up to these ideals are designated as traitors and by other opprobrious names, and the article ends with this threat of persecution to any who do not obey the orders of the Zionist committee thus conveyed. Direct quote here, block quote. "Let him know that at least that it is forbidden him to be called by the name of Jew, and there is to him no portion or inheritance with his brethren, and if after a time they will not try to reform, let them know that we will fight against them by all lawful means at our disposal. Upon a monument of shame we will put their names for reproach and a blaming forever, and until the last generation shall their deeds be written. If they are supported, their support will cease. And if they are merchants, with a finger men will shoot at them. And if they are rabbis, they will be moved far from their office. And with the ban shall they be persecuted. And all the people of the world shall know that there is no mercy in judgment." This was followed about a month later by a second article, also in Hebrew, entitled "Fight and Win," which announced that the threatened persecution would now be carried out. Quote, The names of the traitorous parents and of the boys and girls who have not taken notice of the warnings ought to be published at once and without delay, in the papers and on public notices, placarded at the entrance of every street. The list of these names should be sent to the heads of every institution and to the rulers of the synagogues, to hospitals, to those who arrange and solemnize marriages, and to the directors of the American Jewish Relief Fund, and so on. It should be the title of Blacklist, and Traitors of Their People. An order shall go forth to all, and if one of these men has a son, he shall not be circumcised. In case of death, the body is not to be buried among Israelites. Religious marriages will not be sanctioned. Jewish doctors will not visit their sick. Relief will not be given to them when they are in need, if they are on the list of the American Relief Fund. In short, we must hunt them down until they are annihilated. Men will cry to them, "Oh, out of the way, unclean, unclean!" Because these people will be considered as malicious renegades, there can be no connecting link between them and us. Again, the Society of Young Men and Girls of Jerusalem must accept as its principle to expel from their societies all those who visit these schools, to point the finger of scorn at them, and to make them see that they are put out of the camp. These traitor scholars, boys and girls, must understand themselves that they are sinners and transgressors who are isolated, driven from all society, separated from the Jewish community, and after they have once despised Israel and its holiness, and it will be interdicted to all sons of Israel to come near them. War against the traitors among our people, war by all means legal, war without pity or mercy, that is the traitor, that the traitors may know that they must not trifle with the sentiment of a people. Fight and win. And notice how contrary that is to the white spirit, for good or for bad, and for bad in politics, because we are unable even to separate from those who would purport to take our name and yet associate with Jews. And the Jews are showing you how it's done. They viciously draw a line between themselves and all others in order to protect their racial group. And that fighting and that winning worked for them. The Zionist Committee, of whom one was an American, followed this by a printed announcement that the time of grace had passed, and that forthwith the names of those who were still refractory would be posted publicly on street corners, and the boycott began. Miss Landau, a devout Jewess, the head of the best and highest Jewish school for girls in the city, the Ava Rothschild School, one of these, however, whose pupils and teachers were threatened under these rulings because they would not follow the dictates of the Zionist Committee, appealed to the civil authorities. The committee was hailed into court, and the threatened boycott enjoined. Quote, "Without such an attitude on the part of the Zionist leaders in Jerusalem, it might be expected that violence would ensue. Easter is a time of great excitement and unrest in Jerusalem for Christians, Jews, and Muslims alike, for with Easter coincide the Jewish Passover and the Muslim pilgrim feast of Nebi Musa, when Muslims gather from all over Palestine to hear sermons in the Haram Esh Sharif and then march to the so-called Tomb of Moses near the Dead Sea. The religious excitement of that season, Easter, which vents itself in curses of each against the others, is always likely to produce physical outbursts if the cursers come into contact with one another. The Turks wisely segregated at that time each religion in its own quarter. This, in spite of warnings and requests from the Muslim religious leaders, the English failed to do, either through ultra-confidence in the Pax Anglicana, or because of objections from Jewish representatives against such segregation as applied to them. For days beforehand, hotheads among the Jews and Muslims were inciting to riot, and in their quarter, Jewish-trained bands were preparing for the conflict, a preparation of which Muslims from long want probably had no need. On Easter morning 1920, the fanatical Muslims of Hebron arrived at the Jaffa Gate with their sacred banner, singing their songs of religious intolerance. There, numerous Jews were waiting to greet them. The English Tommies with their officers were all in church. Whose insults were the worst and who struck the first blow is not clear. Battle was speedily joined. The Jews were better armed with guns against the Muslim knives, but the Muslims were the better fighters. The city within the walls was speedily within their hands. The Jews living there were the old-time Sephardic families dwelling close-packed in miserable slums with no sympathy with Zionism. peaceful and quite unprepared. Moslem fury vented itself on these poor wretches. Without the walls, the Jews were in the vast majority. All told, by official count, there were at that time 28,000 Jews, 16,000 Christians, and 14,500 Muslims in Jerusalem. What the Muslim did within the walls, the Jew endeavored to do without the walls. Before my eyes, an Arab camp just below the great Jewish quarters was set upon, burned, and plundered, the poor inhabitants fleeing for their lives while guns popped from the Jewish quarter. Two men were killed there. When the troops reached the scene, the great bulk of rioters whom they rounded up were Jews. The subsequent court proceedings also seemed to place the chief responsibility for the outbreak on them. The major sentences were equally divided between Jews and Muslims, but of the criminals who received lighter sentences, the majority were Jews. For a week we lived in a state of siege, not allowed to pass in or out of the city gates or to show ourselves on roof or balcony after sundown, and for months there were new guards at every turn. Assemblies were prohibited, and there was continual danger of a new outbreak. The appointment of Sir Herbert Samuel, a Jew, as governor of the new protectorate under the Zionist mandate greatly increased the excitement. In Muslim towns like Nablus, it was openly said in my presence that no Jew might enter the place and live. The Christians, who had taken no part in the riots, were nevertheless to a man in sympathy with the Muslims, and one saw the curious spectacle of cross and crescent making common cause. It was prophesied that, should Sir Herbert come as governor, he would never enter Jerusalem alive. In point of fact, he landed at Jaffa and came up to Jerusalem under a strong guard, with machine guns before and behind. In the following week he made a visit to Nablus and Haifa in the same manner. That was the situation when I left Palestine. Sir Herbert at that time had just issued his declaration and his interpretation of the mandate. English officers and officials, almost to a man, were against the Zionist mandate, and their utterances in many cases were extraordinarily frank. Some of the most prominent and best trained sought transfers to other posts because of their feelings on the matter, and some resigned. It has since that time been extremely difficult to obtain reliable information of prevailing conditions. It would seem, however, from all the information I have been able to gather, that Sir Herbert, who is, I believe, not himself a Zionist, has acted with singular tact and discretion. He has shown great fairness and indicated his intention to govern with impartiality, granting no special favors to any, nor allowing any outside committee or local organizations to dictate or assume unfair policies. When I left Palestine, Jews were leaving in considerable numbers, especially those claiming American citizenship, so that the outgo was larger than the income. Since then, if I may judge by reports, Jews have been coming in, chiefly from Eastern European countries, some parasitic and objectionable, others of a higher type. Some of the latter, graduates of universities, both men and women, may be seen engaged in hard manual labor, I am told, building roads and the like, not despising to do such work in order to secure their Palestinian home and fulfill their aspirations. It is too soon to judge the future of Zionist experiment in Palestine. If the English authorities will give fair play to all, and if the Jews will pursue the old policy of the Alliance Israelite and its schools of seeking to benefit all the dwellers of the land alike, to break down, not to build up, religious, racial, and social prejudices, then the Jew may perhaps overcome the present prejudice against him, and his invasion of Palestine may prove to be a blessing both to himself and to the land. The methods of those in control of the Zionist movement in Palestine, while I was there, were, however, aimed in the opposite direction and tended to make the Jew an object of hatred and violence whenever the opportunity for violence offered. This has been illustrated again by the recent bloody riot in Jaffa, which compelled the expedition of a British warship to that port, and the order issued holding up all immigration shows that not Jaffa, but the whole country is unsafe. The Jews in Palestine are now protected only by the force of British arms. Were the British troops withdrawn, the Jews would be exterminated by the angry natives, of whom the Muslims alone outnumber them in a ratio of more than 10 to 1, and with such action the neighboring countries would sympathize, yielding ready assistance if any were required. Mesopotamia and Egypt are seething with disaffection against British rule and racial religious ferment, and Palestine is to them, and to the Arabs of Arabia, a holy land included in the heritage of Islam. Muslim India also feels this keenly, and the British have been obliged to withdraw Muslim Indian troops from Palestine because they will not fight fellow Muslims. In this country, the Jewish problem which we have hitherto had to face is not a result of religious antipathy. Religiously, politically, and economically, the Jew has the same opportunity as everyone else. The Jewish problem has been merely a matter of social prejudice, resulting from the extremely difficult task of amalgamating with great rapidity an enormous population, alien in race, culture, custom, and habit. In 1880, there were, according to Jewish statistics, 250,000 Jews in this country. The Jews now claim 3,500,000 for the most part, an undistributed mass huddled together in a few of the great cities, one-third of them in New York. Coming in such great numbers and in so short a time, and herding together thus, intentionally or unintentionally, they help one another to resist the process of Americanization. This enormously increases the incidence of social prejudice. Those who have no conscious prejudice, either of religion or of race, are in danger of imbibing or developing such prejudice as a method of protection of their institutions, their traditions, and their habits. The Zionist movement, with its intentional development of race consciousness and race peculiarity on the part of the Jew, is an additional obstacle against the efforts of those Jews and those Christians who are seeking to break down prejudice and to bring Jew and Christian together within a common recognition of the Golden Rule, that each should treat the other as he, in like instance, would wish to be treated by him. The Jews don't feel that, of course. One of the greatest English Jews, honored and respected by Jew and Christian alike for his learning, his philanthropy, and his godly piety, says of this racial political Zionism that it has broken his heart and set the clock backward for his people 100 years. The Christian lover of his country and his fellow men may well express a similar feeling on his side. And that concludes chapter 52, talking about conditions in Palestine and the general attitude of the Jews as expressed by the Zionist Committee, and also shows what we're feeling in America. The Jews developing a racial feeling that has nothing to do with religion. It has nothing to do with treating other people fairly. His whole doctrine is that he is a people separate and apart and higher than other people. And this belief is reflected in his behavior, so that the non-Jew must see the Jew for what he sees himself and recognize that he is a menace to all other peoples, a genuine threat to them, as we see today when I read you, when they're filling Europe with Muslims in order to destroy Europe racially and genetically, destroy the white race for all time. There's been a definite increase in the incredible hostility towards whites, now common to the globally controlled Jewish media. And as I read this today at the end of 1915, we're just about to go into 2016, we really see a full frontal assault on the white race by the Jews who operate the mass media. So this is something 100 years ago that shows that same mentality at work. Anyway, find everything that we record at vnnforum.com. I want to thank you for being with me today as we continue to go through Henry Ford's The International Jew, and I'll be back with you again real soon.